So you've been to Chicago. How many times? It's been sunny every time?
50, 60 times.
What can we do to get you back to Chicago?
He wants to sell me. He wants to sell me as like a, you know, weddings and other things. Like,
it's Chicago, it's like 180 days of sun a year. The national average is like 220. Places like Key West get 270. Yeah. Places like Yuma, Arizona get like 310.
I know.
Yeah,
I show up right now, though. November 29th. I turn on WGN. It's like the hottest day in record. And it's sunny and there's bikinis on the river. It's like, yeah, that's me.
I have a different view of Chicago. I grew up in Chicago. I have a Chicago flag tattoo. I mean, it's home.
Look at that.
Yeah, I really like what it was. Like, people say, don't you still love Chicago? I love what Chicago was. I was just there. I was just there doing some work earlier this week, actually. And I met up with a friend of mine, guy that my wife used to work for, actually, in the restaurant business, Jimmy. Jimmy owns a restaurant there, too. And he just was telling me stories. And I'm like, God, it's over for me. I'm done. Now, I lived in the actual city is the difference, right? I lived and worked in the actual city. So there was no escaping it for me as it got worse and worse. Yeah. And I actually lived 4 years in Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles. And that is one of the most beautiful places on the face of the earth. But it made it difficult for startups. And that's why we're talking to you.
For the people who are just tuning in, we eventually are going to let Mark talk as soon as Bobby and I tell tales of our lifetime. But we have Mark McNally, serial entrepreneur.
You're live?
Okay. Yeah, we're live.
We're live. We're taping. Mark McNally, serial entrepreneur, and someone who's been damn good at it, who has some interesting ventures we want to talk about. Something else very interesting, too, is I'm about to have a daughter with the last name of McNally, too, so we're practically family. So is McNally always Irish, or can it be Scottish, too?
Yeah, whatever. Good to go.
It's Californian.
California.
Yeah, my daughter, we're marrying her off to a McNally in the summer. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us, Mark. Yeah. So I would like to ask you a couple questions, because one thing, when I saw the last podcast you were on, and I thought it was absolutely fabulous when you were talking about Nobody Studios, and the one thing that struck me, and I'm going to want you to explain to the people watching what Nobody Studios are, but the one thing that really got me is that so many people like the potential for startups and investing in small companies, you know, the payoff can be so wonderful, but it's so, so risky when you invest in one. And Bobby and I are traders and investors. We talk about diversification portfolios too. An outlet where you can invest in someone who's an expert at picking small companies and starting small companies. Can you please tell us about Nobody Studios?
Look, it's a result of a 27-year career of getting a lot of things right and a lot of things wrong, more things wrong. Fortunate enough to have a lot of successes, and it turned into my, you know, spot in my 45-year midlife moment where I was like, fuck, whatever I do next has got to matter. I cared a lot about taking all those lessons, and I was fortunate to go off a tiny little exit 5 years ago, and I actually took the first sabbatical of my life, 1 year. And in that time frame, I filled 2 notebooks, and I was asking questions like, what went right with that company? What went wrong with that company? And even the ones that actually worked, I was like, what do we do? What could have been better? Right. And it was like shocking how many like obvious lessons were in front of me. But I was lucky enough to have that time to do that. And I was also driven by a moment where I was, you know, midlife, 45, 46, and I had 9, 10-year-old boys, and I've been doing 10 years in machine learning and AI, and that's boring as shit, you know. Don't try to tell your sons, like, let me explain an algorithm. I don't care about that shit, you know? Tell me how you fly a plane or something, you know? So, you know, I was just in this moment of, like, looking for what I was going to do in the second half of my career and really, really caring about that, like, in defining my legacy and, you know, making the world a better place, making my boys proud, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that soul searching was, you know, could have ended up, like, I'm a organic farmer in Africa right now. I would do that if that was the right answer. But the end result was I came out that I was really passionate about startups. I think they're really a profound vehicle where you can say, this should exist, it doesn't exist, and it's irrational. And guess what? I have a chance of pulling together the people and the money to do it. And I have some history in that. And then I also was looking at the vehicle of startups, and I'm like, we're getting some things really radically wrong. And so I started to feel this passion, and this all created a thesis that became the studio, which was, super long story short, we can do things faster. We can do them leaner. We can optimize for early stage exits or mid stage exits versus the unicorn path that everybody was on, which I don't agree with. I believe the world is going to be more diverse than we've ever imagined. I believe it's going to be more global than we've thought of in the past. And yeah, just build a vehicle that leans into that. And that's what I decided to do. And luckily I reached out to a handful of people. I'm like, I'm probably freaking crazy. Tell me I'm wrong. And it just turned into a lot of people saying, no, actually I like that, but you should do this. And I want to put in some money and I want to help you. And holy crap, something happened.
You know, you mentioned something in that short story. You said it was the first sabbatical of your career. Now, if I heard you correctly in one of the podcasts I listened to you on, your first exit, so to speak, you started as an employee, not as a founder. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. I mean, the company that went public, I was technically an employee. Okay. Later on, they called me a founder. But, you know, I joined as I actually started, you know, doing customer support.
Okay, so here's where I'm going with this. You mentioned it was your first sabbatical. Mm-hmm. Jim and I know each other from the trading floor in Chicago, and we know each other well because we were both kind of first on, last off guys in terms of the trading floor. I would see him at 5:45, 6 a.m. He'd see me. And then when everybody else left, we'd be like, yeah, see you later. See you tomorrow. I'll take, you know, we'd be first guys there, last off.
Yep.
Jimmy owns a restaurant as well as being an investor. I got married in 2019. Haven't taken a honeymoon yet. My wife's getting pretty upset. Is that common for people who are successful that they just, they enjoy doing the work rather than necessarily the result of that work? Because that's what it sounds like.
I think so, right? Like, I mean, I do believe that, just barely knowing you guys, right? But I believe that what you just said is probably true. You meet people who are really successful and they'll say, I'll never retire.
Yeah.
Right? I feel that way. Like, I want to do this as long as possible because it keeps my brain going. Right. I enjoy motivating people. I enjoy solving problems. I enjoy the vision. That's what makes me tick. So the opposite of that is hard to fathom. Right. That's what I think is the right answer to what you said.
Do you get, but here's the question. We had Jared Dillian, a buddy of ours who was talking about work, and he was talking about he knew Michael Bloomberg, and Michael Bloomberg says the most exciting part of every weekend is like Sunday at 5 o'clock because he can start thinking about work and all the things he's going to do tomorrow. That's crazy, right? Nobody gets excited about the work week, do they? Come on, let's keep this in reality.
Yeah, you know, I think, look, I'm going through a phase right now, like the last 4 years, I brute forced this from Will to build this company. And Nobody Studios is a funny brand, right? It was intentional. It was meant to be bigger than all of us. And I knew that I would be able to take a deep breath when it was bigger than me. And it was bigger than me years ago. And I'm proud of that. But there'll be a spot, like we're at an inflection point in the next couple months where we're bringing in a shit ton of capital. And we've built an amazing team the last couple of years. So I will able to shift my mentality a little bit. But it's never going to change the fact that I'm in the weeds and I love this stuff and I will do this forever. And it's probably, I have a special knack of doing this stuff, right? But what it will do is, like, I'm inspired by people like Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
I don't know his exact thing, but the rumor is he works at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. right? Like, that turns me on, man. Like, let me sleep in the morning, wake up, go to the gym, be with my kids. Like, it turns me on to think I'm walking in at 1 p.m. and I'm doing my 4 hours of brilliance, right? Like, there's those things that are unique elements of how to manage your life. You can't quite do in the growth stage, and he didn't do it back then either. But, you know, I'm comfortable shifting from 18 hours a day to, you know, 7 hours of brilliance, you know?
Yes, but I genuinely, my wife yells at me all the time because I work, you know, probably 15, 16 hours a day. And I like every hat that I wear, I love it. And I don't want to get rid of it. But there are weeks where I'll be like, oh, shit, that was a long-ass week. I'm not sure. Right. Now, there's something I want to present to you. Because if you would have talked to me 25 years ago, a young, you know, I was, you know, an athlete as Bobby was. And I, you know, captain of three sports in high school, but I was a bad captain because I was not like anything about the team. I was just like, do your goddamn job. You know what I mean? I was very into self-discipline. And then bringing that in my career, I would have never thought that being at a small company would change the way people work because they can view the vision a lot more clearly. I never would have thought that. I just thought you get your job, you do as best as you can, you outwork the other guy and you go home. But now I've realized that you're 100% right here. You go into work and you're a small cog in a big machine. You steal pens and shit like that. People do it. Normal people, like they don't think like of the company. When you're in a small company that has a vision, particularly one that's going to do well, it put people on an entirely different focus level. You'd agree, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that maybe I'll just reflect back to, I think it's a changing world. What I think it used to look like building a small company was more obvious. And now I'm building a small company again and again and again. You know, I think, generationally, it's interesting. You know, you interact with different personalities and different motivations. And I think if you want to be a long-term visionary in this space, you have to be super curious about what's going on with that current generation, the last generation, the new generation, because it's different than how the, you know, three of us would probably talk about it, right? And so I hear it and I'm like, wow, I could be super successful. I just lock into the four guys I know how to make money and I don't have to care about it again. But if I care about making businesses for the long term right now, I have to care about the new generations. And it's a totally different world, right? And you have to decide if you're up for that, right? And I am, but it also stretches us culturally. It always, is a constant challenge to reinvent.
That's interesting. I heard something today, and for the life of me, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name. And I didn't plan on asking you this question, but the CEO of Ralph Lauren, French name. I don't speak French.
Yeah.
So he was talking about how they're the company is very diverse and very inclusive, and they don't do it because of the social pressures to do so. They do it because it's who they are. And then in the same breath, he said, plus if you're younger, nobody wants to work for you unless you are. Is that the same thing? I'm kind of asking you both this. You know, I mean, he said that we don't do it because of social pressures. Yet if we don't do it, younger people won't come to work for you. They just care about that. Isn't that the same thing?
100%. Look, I think who we are definitely emanates from our DNA. And there's no way to fake it, right? There are certain ways to say, I'm GM or I'm Ford, and forgive me if you're part of those guys. I'm just saying, like, these are big established companies that say, hey, we care about this. And it comes across as, this is the right thing to do this year, right? Or we should evolve into this. It's different to say we're building something from the ground up.
And talk our about how you share it if you could. Ground up,
our culture matters, right?
Yeah.
From the very beginning, we have said we care about being global in nature, diversive and inclusive, and it's from our DNA. It's who I am as a human, and even though I'm a white guy from North America, like, I also am not your typical gringo. I've personally built offices in Shanghai and Pakistan, and Dubai, and Mexico City, and London. Most of my best friends are outside of North America. My wife is Mexican. My boys speak Spanish. I'm fluent. Like, I understand the North American world. I am that man. And I have good friends throughout the United States, but that's not my global view.
What I liked about something you said, and I want to throw this in there because I don't think you'll say it about yourself. Something you said when you talked about your company being diverse, you said, I don't think that we want the best person for the job. And I don't think that necessarily is coming from the same specific places that people usually think.
I truly believe the next Facebook's not being created by a 50-year-old white guy in North America.
Yeah.
Orange County. She's going to be a 12-year-old girl in New Delhi, and she's playing Minecraft on her couch right now. So if you want to be relevant to her, not her to us, if you're an investor or you're a builder, then you need to understand how she thinks or be super curious about how she thinks. And you need to approach it in a way that when I interact with those folks, when I'm really lucky to interact with young or old or people from different perspectives, when I occasionally hear from them, thank you for your mentorship, I laugh. Like, not like laugh. I say, no, you understand how much you just mentored me. You are teaching me. I bring something, but you're bringing something else. And together we can do something special. And if you can approach something with that humbleness, and you can approach something with that gratitude, then you can do something special. And we're trying to do this at a broad scale. I expect founders I've never met in parts of the world that I've not been to create companies that I don't even necessarily believe in. And we're going to do something special together. That's what I believe about Nobody.
That's awesome. I'm going to ask you a question. I want to ask you about which particular companies you can describe something that you're totally stoked about. But I'll tell you this real quickly. Like, the reason Bobby and I are here, Bobby and I were in mainstream media for 20 years. Both of us were bounced out of it, not bounced out of it. Some of us walked, some of us went out in a flaming. It's a great story how I went out. But the point of it was, is we started this platform, not necessarily because we want to be in front of a camera and we're narcissists and we want to be stars, which is that much of it. But the reality, a little bit, but anyway, but the reality of it is that we were everywhere we were seeing people who were not necessarily giving their honest viewpoints. They were giving viewpoints that were pre-approved. And I think people deserve better than that. People deserve, even if it's an opinion piece, my opinion may be wrong, but it's got to be really my opinion and not the opinion of some big sponsor, or else it's a bunch of bullshit. But now get back to to the question I was going to ask you. Can you describe a couple, is there something that pops out of your head that you're really excited about of your companies?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's like, I always love that question. It's an obvious one, but it's so rude. It's like, you know, so you've got eight daughters, which one's your favorite, right?
I have a favorite daughter. It changes.
And she knows who she is.
Yes.
The other ones don't know.
No, but here's what I would say. I would frame it in one way. So we have a company called Avalify, and it's the best example because it's our last one. So it's the best way for me to phrase it. We've learned the most out of how we want to build companies. And this company has moved with the most velocity and the most focus and the most early traction. And so it has nothing to do with them personally as a company. It has more to do with our own evolution as a studio, right? Learning how to get good at this. Other companies are on an amazing track, but took longer time or longer money. You know, there's an example of the speed and efficiency that we wanted to figure out, right? So Avalify was originally reached out to me by a group of researchers from IBM who saw one of my posts that we're going to do 100 companies in 5 years. And they reached out boldly and said, hey, you know, what if we could do 10,000 companies in 5 years? And I said, well, yeah, I'm a sucker. Okay, let's talk. And so we started talking. And, you know, they had some really great ideas around IP and how IP should inform company creation. We had that concept internally that IP would, you know, affect what we bet on and what we didn't bet on. So that was kind of aligned. I would say their original idea was very legal tech platform-ish in terms of was going to take them multiple years to build, but we love the guys, just love the humans and love their intellect. And we said, you know what? There's something here to be done. So we crafted a deal to bring their intellect inside. And as soon as we got the deal done, we kind of revealed this broader idea or smaller idea, which was, if you're familiar with Carfax, like if you want to buy a used car, you buy a Carfax, you get a report. We said, what if there's a Carfax on IP? Well, there's a Carfax on a pitch deck. Got super narrow focused on that. And as much as we wanted to stretch, and we're all brainstormers and product people, and we could go in 1,000 directions, we just stayed laser focused on this idea that you could upload a pitch deck and you could get a Carfax report or score. And you could do it in a minute or less for a fraction of the cost that you would hire an attorney if you could, if you wanted to. We nailed that. So we're 5 months into it, MVP is working. You can literally upload a pitch deck, get a score, proprietary score, and an entire report, which would be the equivalent of like a freedom to operate score that you might hire a attorney for $20,000, $249 in 1 minute.
So when you say that, so what your goal is with the upload the pitch deck, you want to make sure you're not infringing on other things that people done. So it involves a massive database that you tap into, correct?
So we tap into 180 million different patents and over 270 different jurisdictions. And then we have our own algorithm to compose that and give you kind of our assessment. But it gives you who else is competing in that space, what other patents you should be worried about, maybe some assessment of what you should or could do to make that patent more interesting and your adjacent possibilities. So it's just like it's a gold mine of knowledge and a click of a button. And what that's turned into has been really exciting. Investors, the target is VCs, high net worth, family offices. It's turned into, you know, insurance. It's turned into so many other areas, the actual IP attorneys themselves, already in revenue, and it's growing fast in terms of people being really excited.
So I can tell you something that I'm excited about that you guys are doing. Can you explain the concept of, and I hope I'm saying this right, low code, no code? And then I'll tell you why I'm excited about that. But if you could explain the concept first to people watching, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, low code, no code as a category is something that's been heavily invested in the last 4 or 5 years, which is a good signal. It's also a signal to figure out what you can do differently. I love the fact that it's been a gazillion dollar category of VC investment for 4 or 5 years, because the concept was you normally hire someone for 200 grand a year to write code. You probably need 20 of those people. And low code, no code is a movement that makes that easier. What I love is that when we made the investment in the space, it was always on intelligent first and being essentially, now you live in a world that's ChatGPT. We believe that we are actually building the first AI native low code, no code. So if you can imagine how fast things have moved in the last 18 months, right? It's exactly the thesis we made when we bought this company. Those are great companies, Bubble, and you know, there's a bunch of other Logic and those other great companies that are established. We just think you're moving into a space that regular people, you know, three of us on this call are going to say, I want this. I need this. It's going to do this. It's going to do that. And it's going to come to life.
Can I ask a quick question? Does every company, when you go on your checklist of company that you want, does it have to be pretty easily scalable? So, you know, technology's main of the main focuses in most of it. Is that correct?
Yeah. Let me interpret that question.
Sure.
Basically. But I believe that everything has to be rapidly scalable. Yes. I've spent half my career in enterprise sales. So the idea that I have to build an enterprise sales team that's going to go golfing and wine and dine and build 2-year sales cycles, I'm not a part of that. The studio won't do that. Our role in that would be to build early stage companies that have digital acquisition and digital growth. So people said, so you don't do enterprise? I'm like, no, I know enterprise better than anybody. So you look at companies like Tableau or Splunk or these other multi-billion dollar companies. They didn't start with an enterprise sales team. They started with a really great tool set that was a downloadable free trial that if you started to get value, you could pull out your credit card and use it as an individual user. And then you could grow into enterprise sales. So Tableau and Splunk both got to $100 million in revenue without enterprise sales teams. So again, I'm completely comfortable building an enterprise product, but it has to be digital growth.
Okay, so like someone coming to you with a stadium project, you're not interested in financing something that's, you know, local in some way, concert venue or, you know, whatever.
I love the questions, right? So first of all, we're not financing, right? So we're not an investor. We are founders. So we want to build something we can scale. I'll never say no to a physical product. I spent half of my career building products for some of the biggest companies on the planet. So I actually know how to manufacture stuff and scale stuff. It's a hard business to be in unless you think you can have a unique angle, at least in physical products, right? So my example to people is, well, I know I could make a great thong or, you know, flip flop. I know it's hard to defend.
I did not know what you meant by thong for a brief second there.
I know you like that. But I would do an Aura ring. So if you caught me 10 years ago and said, here's the Aura ring, it could do this, it could do that. If you caught me early enough, I'd be like, that's something we should build because it's unique and we could own that, right?
Right. But it's not digitally scalable. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a product that I think we can have IP, right? And you also can build brand relationships. So that intrigues me. But we're business model maniac. So sometimes there's a product innovation and there's business innovation, you know, and this has been written in, you know, 2 or 3 different books, but there's a difference between, like, you know, TWA innovated airlines. They made it sexy and they built these, you know, great, you know, lounges, and they made the, you know, stewardesses wear certain things, the captain wears certain things, and they made, you know, air travel really sexy. And Southwest came along and said, screw all that. We're going to be cheap. you're not going to go to DFW, you're going to go to Dallas Love. But I'm going to do hub and spoke, and I'm going to make it cheap. That's a business model innovation. And I love business model innovations. I'm just looking for ways to scale things, right? So if there's a way to scale something, and we're actually on a few right now that are unique angles to, we know how to scale, apply capital, marketing, and I just want to make sure it's repeatable and scalable and it's efficient. So
I want to go back to the question I asked on the company I'm talking about, which is ThoughtForma. And the reason I want to ask about this is the low code, no code, because I got a quick story for you guys. And Jimmy, you don't know the story either. In 1997, I was actually working on the trading floor. A buddy of mine comes up to me, a guy who was an analyst in the office, comes up to me and goes, look at this. You can make golf reservations online now. Right. And I had just recently gotten an email address. So I was like, wow, this is cool. He goes, yeah, you just go online and you just pick a time and then you have to call and confirm it, but it's in there. Right. That night I went to make a restaurant reservation. Right. Now, Jimmy owns a restaurant, but my family was in restaurants. I worked in my father's Italian bakery starting at the age of 14, and we supplied restaurants. So we both have a little bit of a restaurant background. And I said to my wife at the time, I said, you know, this should be a thing. So then I said it to the analyst guy who had booked the golf. I said, you should be able to do restaurants like that. I go, restaurants still use a book. Like they still write stuff and take phone calls and scratch you off. It's this ugly book. We should do this. A couple of weeks later, he comes to me and said, we should definitely do this. This guy, and his name was Todd Kobayashi, and his friend Mike Lee had just finished Harvard Business School. And he said, let's do it together and let's bring in Mike and let's build this thing. So my thought was, we'll do laptops. There were no tablets yet. We'll do laptops. We'll bring them to all the restaurants. We'll give them the laptop, right? We'll say, look, you can still use your book if you want. Just put it in both places. And when somebody logs it online, scratch it off of the book and like, did a business plan, put the whole thing together. And then one day Mike Lee calls me. It was like mid 1998. And he goes, hey, is this you? I'm going to email you something. And it was OpenTable, right? And we even had the name. It was going to be called table4.com, right? And I was like, well, that's it for me, right? I could never do a tech thing again. And now you have ThoughtForma, right? Which if I have an idea, because obviously I don't have the ability to code something. And I do actually have a couple of ideas in finance, but, and that is so, it is so exciting to me to think that I could actually do this and say, okay, this sort of works. Now I could bring it to somebody like Mark and say, hey, this sort of works. Is this a good idea? Would you put this up on your whiteboard or not? Yeah. And that's the point of it, right? For everyday people, ThoughtForma.
I think ThoughtForma is definitely part of that, right? Mm-hmm. But I would say the studio is the biggest part of that. Mm-hmm. Because I think that the how is not as important as the what, and ThoughtForma is part of our how, but it's not the how, right? We're really smart guys, been doing this for a long time in lots of different categories. So what I care about is what are we trying to solve for and what's the right way to do it? Mm-hmm. And ThoughtForma is one of our great assets, but it's not the only asset, right? But I love what you just said, because I say this often. The study of OpenTable is a few things. What I love about OpenTable most is it was a Trojan horse. It became the operating system for restaurants. Mm-hmm. And that's not what you thought, and that's what they thought.
No, it's not.
It became that.
I thought it would
be. So OpenTable is like a toast sort of thing too? Like some restaurants use that as a...
OpenTable became how you manage your reservations.
Oh, that just the reservation part. But it hasn't branched into other things. Okay.
But it became tables. It became cash flow management. It became how you manage your staff. The staff would actually get scheduled based on what was going on with OpenTable.
Wow.
So, but it started out with the Trojan horse because it's so easy. If you went to every restaurant and said, you're going to use me as your operating system, every restaurant would say, piss off.
Get out.
Whatever, right? But they just said, no, we're going to start out with, I've got some leads for you. They want to book tables.
So you're in the door.
Yeah. And you said, okay. And that became a bigger business. Now, they sold for $1 billion, which probably should have been like $100 billion.
Yeah, I didn't get any of that, by the way.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't either. Successful exit. Good for you guys.
Yeah.
But OpenTable, if they would have stayed, you know, the course, I'm sure it'd be a $100 billion company right now.
And you mean like expand into everything in that
they
restaurant?
They already were. Yeah.
Okay, that's fascinating to me. Can we branch into, like, you said you own companies, but the money, what's going to be the financial an opportunity takeaway for someone who might be watching this show who has some dough? Where does the money come from that gets tossed around?
Yeah, that was a generic question. Let me phrase it. Let me answer it just like that.
No, yeah, whatever you want.
We build companies for a living. People who invest in the studio automatically get a part of everything we create. So there's no independent investment decision or, you know, other factor to be done. We have a group of funds and we deploy that to build companies. Our model is to be majority owner of the companies we create. We're not passively investing into good ideas. We are founders and we like to recruit founders around the good ideas we like. And it usually means we're the majority shareholder of the company, kind of seed stage. Maybe past seed stage, not so much. But the economics are anybody who gets involved as a founder level mentality, they are getting obviously the stake we can give in the company. They're not worrying about capital and they're not worrying about the rest of their founding group because we're marketers and technologists and we're, you know, the full gamut. But we're also helping them make sure they have the full gamut of capital they're going to need moving forward. But we do this kind of special thing, which is if you're part of any company we create, you're part of everything we create. You might have X percent in a Nuco, but you also have a percentage of the entire studio. And we create this kind of Keiretsu effect, which is we're all working towards the same thing. And you might be completely rat hole gym on Nuco 27, but Nuco 14 exits, you get your piece of it, right?
That's what I said at the beginning. That's what I love about the whole notion is diversification of startups, right?
Yeah. And for founders, because investors usually think that way. But to offer that to founders is brand new. And I think that's why we're bringing a really unique group of people that have 1,000 opportunities that are really glad to come here, roll up their sleeves, and they feel like they're part of something bigger and it's special.
Yeah, I think that's genius. And that's one of the things that actually attracted me to having this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
You may or may not know Mark, but I have a really close friend who is a part of you guys.
Oh, okay.
And I'll just leave it at that. I don't know if he wants his name mentioned or, you know, doesn't really matter. But this guy used to work for me. And in very short order, I figured out I should have been working for him. Yeah. I never told him until he finally left. And then I was like, can you give me a job? And he said, no. But
no, you're a dick boss. No. You're out.
No, I stood up in his wedding and he said to me, he goes, you know, you and sort of all the people you know should be on Ovation. And that's how that sort of started. So can you tell us about Ovations? I'm actually on there now, but I haven't. I mean, I just got it on. But can you talk about Ovations a little bit? It's one of the companies you founded.
Ovations at a high level is just a platform to connect amazing speakers into virtual environments. Backstory is I've been doing global businesses for a long time. Pre-pandemic, I was involved in a sales and marketing organization where I was a consultant to a big company growing out of Asia. And I found myself on all these calls where I was a senior leader, but I had, you know, leaders of sales from Singapore and, you know, Germany and, you know, Jersey and all these different people. And I was like, I'm trying to present this like national plan of sales and motivation and incentives for like 3 hours. And they're so goddamn bored, right? They're all tuning out in like 15 minutes. I'm like, if I was doing this in like, you know, Vegas, like an Oracle world, if I was doing this in person, I would have different speakers coming in. I would do different things to like keep people, you know, galvanized. So I crafted the idea back then. And then COVID happened and I'm like, okay, this is a bigger idea. And then I created Nobody Studios. I'm like, that's an idea I'm not letting go of. And I think it's now we all live in a virtual world. And so it became something we were passionate about. I was fortunate enough to recruit Ray Leonard Jr. as CEO, Ray's Sugar Ray's son. So he's been in this, you know, speaker world and the celebrity world for a long time. And the laser focused mentality was, how do you bring world-class talent into a virtual world at click of a button? Sounds simple, but no one's done it. Calendaring, booking, et cetera. And now we're really into this like pursuit of themes and like series. So imagine, hey, I want to book 12 of the best AI speakers for the next 12 weeks, but I can do it for 14 minutes and pop it into my normal sales meeting or my normal staff meeting, you know? So it's virtual speakers live. They're going to do their presentation and they're open for interaction. Like, I just think it's almost like a mastermind for enterprise or mastermind for business. super excited about the trajectory. The talent's world class, and we're starting to see some amazing revenue. So, yeah, just excited where it can go.
I love what you just said about something about presentation and presenters, and you talked about the attention span of the listeners. I've heard some of the speakers who have the most to say. I heard an AI speaker at the conference I spoke at in Arizona, and what he was saying was fascinating. And yet he was putting the entire crowd to sleep all at the same time. And then, and Bobby and I, who present, you know, quite a bit live and digitally, but like for me, it's like if I can have 80% of the good content as him, but I can be someone who pulls their engagement in, and I'm not certain how to do that yet, but I know that it is my goal to always be doing that. And sometimes if people walk away going, "Wow, that guy is over caffeinated. He paces up and down the stage." That's better than saying, "Oh, I missed it because I was dozing off." But you hit on something which I think is very important. And I'd rather have them say the guy's a lunatic than to say the guy's boring.
Yeah, it's been interesting for us. We talked to like literally amazing world class like authors and speakers and stuff. And we say, "What's your 8-minute speech?" Mm-hmm. And they're like, "Do you have any idea what people pay me for 2 hours?" And we're like,
"We don't want 2 hours."
Yes, we do. But, you know, and actually a big part of what we do now is focused on training and giving them examples and actually let them send us recordings for 8 minutes, you know, and we give them feedback and like just saying like, we only care about making you, this is a new thing. It's okay. People are not used to doing what you're doing brilliant for 8 minutes. But if you just do that, now you're giving people a small little, you know, tidbit that people buy and pay for all day long. But if you're good, they're going to hire you for more stuff. So don't worry about that. You know,
it's really amazing. Like anytime I open up YouTube now, they feed you those shorts, right? Mm-hmm. And the shorts, I watch shorts over and over again. So many creators, so many influencers have gotten me to subscribe to their channel because I watched 20 shorts before I watched any one whole video. Yep. And I didn't even know it was happening to me, dude. Like, I didn't even know it was fucking happening. Oh, I go, why do I keep watching this guy who says, "You telling me for 40 years I've been doing this?" You ever see that guy? He's brilliant. I want to hang out with him. Not important.
Because it's neuroscientists. They know your attention span. They know where you're going to look. They're all crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. And Jim and I are actually speaking at a conference April 12th in Miami. We got a 20-minute keynote, and we've got two people on the stage with us. So it's literally going to be bursts of 8 minutes each.
I love it. I love
until
it.
Until we go over that. And I then we've got it. A 45-minute breakout after that, in which case we can actually get our points across.
So, I love it.
Yeah, that'll
be Bobby and Jim, I'd like to turn this back on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I love you guys.
You think that for a second we don't want to talk about ourselves, then you don't know us well enough.
I know. I just had a hunch.
Right.
Yeah, I love you guys. Yeah, I love your personalities already. And I know we could hang out and have a good time. You see what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And you hear a little bit what I'm trying to do. Yeah, I'd love to hear your own guidance, what you're seeing, and like things that you think that we should be thinking about or ways you could help us or whatever. Just like open. I love this saying, first of all, there's lots of right answers. So this is open-ended exploration.
You want me to go, Jimmy?
Sure.
Your example of Valify. Jimmy and I have spent our careers making rich people richer, right? And sort of in the same vein of what you said, it was like, I want to make my kids proud of me. I don't have kids. And Jimmy's kids are proud of him already, I think. I'm not sure.
Oh.
I might be making that up.
The one that was my favorite.
I always tell people that if people were to learn active investing or any level of investing from Jimmy and I and some of the people we know, there would never be another Bernie Madoff. And I personally feel like most of the investing content specifically out there, but the platforms as well, and I'll give you a specific example, are designed for people to just get into the juice of investing. Yeah. And not the actual smarts of it, or not the actual, people don't learn about compounding. People don't learn about thinking in percentages rather than dollars. People don't learn about, well, this is biotech, so it's high risk, high reward, and the two are inseparable. This is a grocery store chain. One of the stocks I really like is Sprouts Market, right? And it's SFM. And it's because they do affordable organic, right? Organic's not going anywhere. affordable as inflation continues to go up becomes important even to people that are upper middle class who still want to eat organic, right? But people will look at that and go, that stock barely moves. But they don't know they can take a bigger position in that stock with lower volatility. No one is creating, and the specific example I was going to give you was Robinhood, how they gamified trading. Great for profits, shitty for the people trading. Really shitty for the people trading because they got all excited about the balloons and the noises that happen when they put a trade on, right? Investing and specifically trading is not a video game. It has very serious ramifications. And a lot of the platforms and the people out there doing it now are just trying to get people in. I told a company years ago, I was in New York, this particular company, Jimmy, you don't know the story either, was taking me to Qatar to speak, Doha, right? And I was amazed by that. I went to, you know, went to the inland desert and rode camels, and it was an amazing trip. And I, on the plane over, I told these guys, I said, you know, you guys are a public company. And in your earnings reports, you release turnover, account turnover. And man, all of your guys' account turnover is so high. Wouldn't you like to go into an investor meeting and say, our account turnover is 20% lower than our competition? Wouldn't you like to go into the market and say that? Actually say to people, our competitor, their account turnover is 70%. Ours is 40% because we're better at this than everybody else. Yeah. That is the thing to me. It's part of the reason I do this with Jim and my other partner, Mike Arnold. Part of the reason we do this, because Jimmy will tell you in his trading, every single thing in his trading is about limited losses and upside. Yeah. Everything he does. And he tells our audience this. That to me is unserved. Not just underserved, but it's unserved.
Well, and to add to what Bobby said too, and this is one of the challenges that we face, you know, the news outlet that I had a fantastic blow up with, which is still one of my proudest moments.
CNBC, they suck. Go ahead.
Okay, but he said the name of it too. But in the exit interview with the place I went, they were like, just because something's true, you can't say it on air. And I said, if I'm talking about like an ugly baby, you can't say it. I'll say your baby's cute. But if it has something that's pertinent to the audience, I don't agree with that. And they were like, and then I stopped them and I go, listen, I'm not saying that my integrity here isn't for sale, but I am saying your 2-0 is too short. I thought that was really funny. They didn't think it was funny at all. Right? So I can be bought. But the point I'm trying to make is they put people on pedestals like Kathy Wood and Michael Saylor. And these seem like very nice people to me. And they had a hunch and they bet it all. But then they make it out like if you're not making billions of dollars like Kathy Wood is, you're doing something wrong. And humans are absolutely 100% wired to be terrible investors. We feel momentum. When something's going up crazy, we're like, I got to be involved. When something's going through the floor, it's like, I got to get out. I can't take any more losses. So everything about investing, trading on medium and short term is about controlling your emotions. And George Costanza told us it on Seinfeld when he was pretending he was a stock investor. It was the most important thing I've ever learned about stock investing. He said, when everything in my mind tells me I should be selling, I buy. And that was the Costanza rule on Seinfeld. And it was 100% right. But anyway, so our whole thing, the challenge we've met is they want you to sensationalize. We want to make boring things more sensational and fun to talk about.
Yep.
And they can be, because making money over time is good. Yes, I've had some really, really good ideas that if I would have jumped on and been a cowboy and not had stops in place and not had options to hedge it, I could be a lot wealthier than I am now. But that's not the way to sleep at night. Like even now, yesterday on Fox, they had it on. Actually, I was on their front page of Fox Business's website because I said, bulls can make money, bears can make money, pigs get slaughtered. And that's an old saying in our business. As soon as you start forgetting the risks, you are absolutely screwed. Bobby and I had to deal with that for a long time. So our challenges are getting away from people telling us what to say, getting away from absolutely trying to sell a get rich quick scheme, because there is no goddamn get rich quick schemes. Anything you can get rich in quickly, you can get poor in quickly too. Like Truth Social, they're coming out with their IPO yesterday, and Fox are like, are you going to participate in this? Why would I participate in this? You know what I mean? It could be up 30%, down 40%. It's like, give me a pair of dice. Let's have some fun with that instead. I'll bet you $1,000 right now. So stuff like that. That's our challenge. Yeah. And the funny part is that at first I thought, we're not going to find an audience for this. Bullshit. We found a big audience for it.
Yeah,
people watch our show and they like it and they trust us. You know what? Because when we mess something up, we say we mess something up. And other people just like, they've never been wrong. Everybody else on TV.
Bobby. Mark's going to be sorry he asked this question now because we won't shut up about it. But
no,
here's the thing, Mark. Real quick talking, example. I struggle to explain to people that the person who made the most money didn't necessarily put on the best investment. And the way you look at it is if investors need to think more in percentages. And I'm going to make an assumption that a lot of venture exits end up with percentage conversations rather than, you know, ROI, rather than actual, this is the amount of money we made. I could be wrong about that. But I tell somebody, look, one person can make $3,000, another can make $300. And if they both made 30%, they both put on the exact same trade. And it was both of them performed well because it depends on the capital invested or the capital allocated for this particular type of investment in the first place.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's what we struggle with. And that's where we think it's underserved. And that's why we got on these platforms in the first place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. So Jim and Bobby, I'll end with a challenge. And obviously I'm doing my best to flip the script here. You know, I took a company public when I was 24. We had created a lot of wealth. One of our biggest investors pre-IPO had another stake in a big company and he was in Manhattan. It was wild. And he called us and he's like, you guys need to be here tomorrow. And we're like, what? He's like, I just met these market makers back when that was actually a thing. Your ticker is going across the board all day long. They're making a fortune on you and they say you're a dog. Obviously, we've done really well. We went, you know, IPO, we're worth like $1 billion. And we're like, well, yeah, we'll see. We'll be in Manhattan in a few weeks. We'll see them. They're like, no, you don't understand. You need to be here now. And so we boarded, you know, the plane and we went out there. The next morning, I was at this market maker in New York and I saw this trade and they're like, and they met us for breakfast first. They decided they liked us. Two 25-year-old guys making $5 million a year. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay. We've been making a fortune off your stock. But now that we know you know this guy and you know that guy and we like you guys, come by our office at the close of trade. And so we showed up the last 30 minutes and we watched all these trades coming in. And they're like, okay, let me tell you what's going on because we've been making a fortune off your stock. At the end of the day, all these kind of, you know, bids are going to come in at the end or, you know, asks are going to come in at the end. And you're going to be wanting to go to the moon. And you're going to end up going down and you're going to end up flat. And they predicted it. Mm-hmm. And we watched this play out. And it was the last 5 minutes. And we watched gazillions of dollars go through our stock. And they said, you want to see who's doing it? And we said, of course.
Yeah.
And they unlocked it. And it was a banker that will remain unnamed. Was a banker that was highly involved in our public offering.
Really?
And they were dumping huge shares at the end. Because they know they could trade higher in the morning and they were just doing this money machine.
Mm-hmm. Makes me sad to think there's manipulation like that.
And yeah. Because they knew that was possible, they were betting on that. And so, you know, I was in the room when my CEO called the managing director of that very large firm and said, you are 4 minutes away from a class action lawsuit. And he's like, what? What are you talking about? We have dinner like 2 days before with the guy. He's like, what? What? No. He's like, this is unequivocal. Hung up. 3 minutes later, the trades dried up and we closed at our all-time high. Yeah. And we went to an all-time high for 60 days straight. 2-for-1 split, 3-for-2 split, literally increased about $3 billion in market cap in probably 3 months.
Wow.
From that moment that nobody gets a chance to see what I just saw that moment, like live right. Through that, right?
Yeah. Nobody knows they lose confidence in people when they know of these manipulations. But anyway, go on. Yeah.
But that was, you know, 1999 versus now. Now you add robotics and you add, you know, we have two of our biggest investors who are some of the best human beings I know are CTOs of the largest quant funds in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, where has this market gone? Right. So my challenge to you, Bobby and Jim, is let me come in because I'm not a trader and I'm not an investment advisor. I just lived through this stuff a lot. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that there's a missing, you know, dynamic in terms of challenging this and what people should think and what they should do and how they should invest and where they should prioritize stuff. And I'm a willing participant if you want to let me be that antagonist.
Whatever. Awesome. Absolutely. That's great to hear. It's also great to talk to you too. I think what you do is fascinating. And I think that people who are going to watch this are going to think it's fascinating too. It's Mark McNally, serial entrepreneur and very damn successful at it. But the most important part is Nobody Studios. So if you guys are listening, go and check that out. I assume it's nobodystudios.com. Is that how to check it out? That's where you get information on it too. But as always, I want to thank you guys watching this too, because this would be nothing without you guys. Remember what our mission was and why we did it. We were involved in mainstream media. We thought a lot of it was bullshit. We thought we needed transparency and to be more frank with you guys. If we have no idea about something, we say we have no idea about something. So thank you guys a million for all the retweets, all the telling people, the marketing, and all you do for us. Thank you guys. This is the Futures Edge Show.